A British politician famous for his anti-establishment views, George Galloway, has been sworn into Parliament after his sweeping election victory. His platform toplined the crisis in Gaza, bringing the masses out to vote for him as the MP for Rochdale. Well, Galloway gained nearly 40% of the vote in this landslide win. He didn't hold back during the campaign, criticising the leaders of Labour and the Conservative parties in the UK and accusing both sides of backing Israel against Gaza. Now, Galloway's views are not new. He once described former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair as being a mass murdering war criminal for Britain's role in bombing Iraq. He's also attended anti-war protests for Syria and went against London's official policy by stating that Russia is winning in Ukraine. George Galloway has also been the host of his own popular show on RT. Downing Street was quick to call Galloway's victory beyond alarming.
Now our democracy itself is a target. Council meetings and local events have been stormed. MPs do not feel safe in their homes. Long-standing parliamentary conventions have been upended because of safety concerns. And it is beyond alarming that last night the Rochdale by-election returned a candidate who dismisses the horror of what happened on October the 7th, who glorifies Hezbollah.
I don't know what that means, backed Hezbollah. I oppose Israel's occupation of Lebanon. And I respect the right of people in occupied territory to resist their occupier.
The community.
Who won the election? Me or Rishi Sunak? I've got the democratic mandate here, not Rishi Sunak. He didn't even come second.
Don't keep Statement. Telling me about the Prime Minister as if he was Moses.
Do you not respect the Prime Minister?
Do I respect the Prime Minister? I despise the Prime Minister. And guess what? Guess what? Millions and millions and millions of people in this country.
However, his election victory seems to be a point of contention for a number of British ministers. Some are actually considering a ban on political activity of officials, saying that they are cooperating with pro-Palestinian activist groups. One of them is the Palestine Solidarity Campaign that has called for Palestinian refugees that were detained by the IDF to be released. Now, his victory comes as the leader of the Houthi group has said the British Prime Minister bore responsibility for a recently hit cargo ship in the Red Sea, tagging George Galloway's name to a post.
We say to Sunak, you and your government bear responsibility for the ship, the MV Ruby Mar, and the responsibility of supporting the genocide and siege in the Gaza war. You have a chance to salvage the MV Ruby Mar by sending a letter of guarantee signed by George Galloway saying relief trucks will enter Gaza at an agreed time.
Well, let's cross live to the main man of the story, George Galloway himself, member for UK Parliament for Rochdale. Thank you very much for joining us here on RT International, Mr. Galloway. First of all, congratulations on your recent success there. What do you think is the reason behind your electoral success in Rochdale? Why do you think the voters chose you specifically over the more established candidates there?
Well, this is my seventh parliamentary victory, which means I've served more time in here than the vast majority of members, and far more than combined, the Prime Minister Sunak and the leader of the opposition, Starmer. So it's partly that people see me as an experienced parliamentarian with a certain gift for the job, and so they keep electing me, and that's what Rishi Sunak finds beyond appalling. What is actually beyond appalling is, first of all, that the governing party in Britain didn't even come second, was lucky to come third, and garnered only a tiny handful of votes. And equally alarming, beyond alarming, is that the official opposition came, I think, fifth, maybe sixth, with an even smaller handful of votes. What that tells you is there's a crisis in Britain. Our country is being steered by people almost bereft of public support. And when someone comes along with the ability to credibly win an election, people choose that option. I've described the governing party and the opposition as two cheeks of the same backside. And when people get the opportunity, they give both cheeks a good kicking.
You touched briefly on what I want to ask you about, and this is British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak describing as your democratic election as being beyond alarming. I mean, incredibly interesting that a sitting British Prime Minister has taken the time to address the nation about your election as an MP in Rochdale. Why is it, do you think, that not just he, but the whole of the establishment feel threatened by your election?
Well, they fear me, first of all, because by the grace of God, I know how to do this job. If in football terms, one-on-one against the goalkeeper, I almost always score a goal. So they fear me. But more important than fearing me, they fear the power of example. They fear that all over the country, people that agree with me on the basic things, whether in my party, the Workers' Party of Britain, or as independents, that they will come forward now, encouraged to stand and perchance to win. And if not to win, to decisively influence the outcome of the election. So we've upset the apple cart, to use an English saying. We have sent the apples spilling everywhere, and no one quite knows where it's all going to end up now. They thought, and they have for generations, that the people would vote for Tweedledee or Tweedledum. It wouldn't much matter which. Each would have their term in their turn in government, but nothing much would change. Attitudes to the world, attitudes to the economy, and so on. Nothing much would change. Now, it's entirely unpredictable. Because I do want to stress to your audience that I didn't just win, I won a landslide. And the man who came second was an independent that no one in the country had ever heard of before. And between that independent second place candidate and me, we got 2/3 of the votes, which means that the government and the opposition and 9 other parties shared 1/3 of the votes. So this is a pretty remarkable result.
There's no doubt it was a landslide election. You took almost 40% of the vote. I think it was 6,000 votes more than the nearest person who came in second. I know that you have been somebody who has upset the apple cart over and over. Some people have suggested that you grabbed on to what's happening in Gaza and used that as a platform. But I know from your background that you've been a prominent supporter of Palestinians and their cause since the 1970s. Why do you think at the moment there are so many UK politicians who are trying to stop the mass pro-Palestinian protests that we are seeing in the UK, people supporting the Palestinian cause and demanding an end to the war, the violence, and calling for a ceasefire? Why are they so against it?
It is remarkable. I wish I knew the answer to that. If this was the United States, I'd say it was about money, because money is very, very big in American politics, and the supporters of Israel give very, very large sums of money. I'm talking hundreds of millions of dollars. But in Britain, money doesn't affect elections quite so much. A by-election maybe, because you have a bigger spending limit, about £100,000. But in parliamentary elections, we're only allowed to spend about £14,000 on a contest. So unless they're terribly cheap, these politicians, it's probably not money. Whatever else it is, I've struggled for more than 50 years to work out. It certainly isn't Britain's national interest, because Britain's national interest does not require us to become the second or third most hated country in the world, and having completely burned all of our bridges, which were once considerable, by the way, as an imperial power, in the Arab and Muslim world. You know, the British Empire was so vast that upon it the sun never set, though, as my Irish grandfather used to say, that's because God would never trust the British in the dark. And he was right about that. The truth is, I don't know the reason why. All I know is that almost everyone who ever makes it into power in Britain is a member of the Friends of Israel. Very few are members of the Friends of Zimbabwe or Turkmenistan or even Ghana. But they almost obligatory, have to be in the Conservative or Labour Friends of Israel. And it's most perplexing because it's immoral. It is obvious to anyone with eyes that the great crimes that are being committed in Gaza right now are not something that any decent person should be supporting. But it's also politically mystifying, because all it does is make the politicians here hated by a larger and larger number of their own voters, and hated even more by more and more countries around the world. The entire global south, the entire Arab Middle East, the entirety of West Asia, South Asia, Southeast Asia, not to mention Eastern Europe, China, Russia, and so on. We make ourselves the bad guys for a country of 7 million people led by someone like Benjamin Netanyahu. It doesn't add up.
Mr. Galloway, you're elected in a by-election. The UK, by law, will have to have a full general election at some point during 2024. So this could be a fairly short mandate. You may be re-elected. In the time that you are the MP for Rochdale, what will be your priorities?
Well, my number one priority is to, as I put it, you may have heard a similar slogan before, to make Rochdale great again. Rochdale was once one of the most prosperous towns in England, and now it's one of the poorest. Its heart has been taken out. So my first priority is to get Rochdale back up the league, to use another footballing parlance. But obviously, in the midst of this emergency, my first parliamentary intervention will be, God willing, tomorrow at Prime Minister's Questions, when I'll be talking about the plausibly described as genocide that's going on in Gaza. When the highest court in the whole world sends you for trial on genocide, having concluded by a landslide majority of the judges that it is perfectly plausible that what you're doing is genocide, well, it doesn't get much bigger than that.
Well, I mean, you're talking there about the international politics. Obviously, your views on this are well known. You've been talking about them there. How do you think you as one MP can help the situation now that you've been elected once more? What is it that your voice can bring to the people who are suffering in Gaza in particular?
Well, there are millions in Britain who demand an end to this slaughter, but they're not properly represented here in the British Parliament. They're not properly represented either in quantity or in quality. So I'll add a bit to both of those. It's true I'm only one MP, and in a way it depends who that one MP is. If it's someone with a proven track record of scoring a lot of football goals, a lot of political football goals, then I think you're going to see an uptick. I called an impromptu press conference outside Parliament yesterday afternoon, and more than 30 television camera crews turned out. That means they're aware of the scale of the importance of this parliamentary by-election result. They know that it might change things. They know that it could conceivably change everything. If it affects the outcome of the British general election, if it makes all the parties either change or threaten them with being changed, then it will have been a very significant night indeed last Thursday.
I want to talk about Gaza specifically now, and about the possibilities of first a ceasefire and then a long-lasting peace. How do you think those can be achieved?
Well, first of all, a ceasefire is necessary but woefully insufficient. As you rightly say, I've been in this cause since the 1970s. That's a long time by anybody's reckoning. And I have seen more ceasefires than I could possibly count. A ceasefire, particularly a Kamala Harris ceasefire for 6 weeks, is merely the precursor to a resumption of violence on both sides. Is merely a precursor to more slaughter on both sides. And so, whilst of course I support a ceasefire, that is not nearly enough. There must be a ceasefire. There must be a complete withdrawal of occupation forces from Gaza, which I remind you is internationally recognized illegally occupied territory. Israel has no right to be there legally. And following on from that withdrawal, then we can have an all-for-all exchange of hostages, prisoners, call them what you will. There are thousands and thousands of Palestinian hostages or prisoners, depending on how you want to describe them. And then there has to be, as President Putin himself said many times during this crisis, there has to be an immediate, and I mean immediate, establishment of a Palestinian state. You know, I supported the Oslo Agreement, but I've been supporting it for more than 30 years. Where is it? Where is the so-called two-state solution? Now, if we don't get that, then another prison breakout from Gaza is guaranteed, and more bloodshed on both sides is guaranteed. And we'll all be back having this conversation all over again.
I want to stay in the region now and talk about the Houthis and their involvement in this. The fighters, the Houthi fighters in Yemen, they've demanded a letter of guarantee from the UK Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, that relief trucks would be allowed to enter Gaza. But apparently they believe that they will only believe the letter if it's also signed by you personally. What do you make of that?
Well, I was a little surprised to see it. I didn't particularly welcome it, but of course I'm ready to serve Britain's legitimate national interests. And if we have a legitimate national interest in salvaging this ship, and if I can be of any help, then of course I'll give it. I wrote to David Cameron, the British Foreign Secretary, just this morning, saying that I'd seen these reports. I know nothing about them. They're not coordinating with me, I quickly stress. But I've seen these reports, and if there is anything I can do, I'm ready to do it. But the main lesson I draw from this is that the so-called armada that Joe Biden assembled to quell the uprising of the people of Yemen in support of the women and children being slaughtered in Gaza doesn't appear to have worked very well. First of all, hardly any countries joined it. Some of the countries that joined it have pulled out. It is not possible, it appears, to protect international shipping in the Red Sea from these Yemeni attacks. But given that the Yemenis' only demand is that aid trucks be allowed into Gaza, why can't we negotiate our way out of that dilemma? Why can't we make sure that the women and children in Gaza have something to eat? What's wrong with that? And what's wrong with a government that would refuse that?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, in the last couple of days, we reported that at least 15 children have already died of starvation. That was just at one Gaza hospital. I just want to move on to a different conflict now and talk about Ukraine. Is there any chance, do you think, that UK leaders at some point would be interested in settling the issue over Ukraine, the conflict there, rather than perhaps provoking it?
Well, I hope so. And of course, I'll work for that. Early signs are not great. The father of the House of Commons, who led me into the chamber to swear in yesterday, very purposefully, wore a tie, which was in fact a Ukrainian flag. and only the sharp-eyed will have noticed it already, but I noticed it immediately. So the early signs are not that great. But the again, you know, facts get in the way of political rhetoric and political ambition. The wish does not become the reality. And the wish that Russia should be defeated in the proxy war over the dead bodies of Ukrainians waged by NATO does not in any way guarantee victory. Indeed, it has been the prelude to complete defeat. So NATO has been comprehensively defeated, I would argue humiliated, in this proxy war. The one thing you can say has been proved is that Russia will not be conquered. It will not be balkanized, broken up into pieces, the better to be feasted upon and exploited, turning one piece against the other in the interests of an American-led NATO alliance. We can say for sure now that is not going to happen. And so, you know, why reinforce failure? Or as my mother used to say, why throw good money after bad? We've already beggared our economies in pursuit of this foolhardy mission. And now that we know that it has failed, why keep sacrificing young, I say young, it's older and older Ukrainian men, and now even women are in the graveyards in Ukraine. Why keep sacrificing more and more Ukrainians? Why keep beggaring more and more of our economies? Germany's deindustrialization, Britain's in recession, the self-harming effect of sanctions on Russia is such that you like to think that somewhere in government there's a pragmatic voice saying, you know, we need to cut our losses here. And that's certainly what I'll be fighting for, as I always have done.
Do you think that the former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson should be held responsible, not just for, as you say, beggaring the economy of the UK and potentially other countries in Europe, but also for sabotaging the peace talks back in 2022?
Very much so. And he's lucky that he's no longer in this building, or I'd be giving him that piece of my mind right directly into his ear. The crime that Boris Johnson committed against the peace of the region, the danger to the peace of the world, and the material economic damage which he has done thereby, not just to Europe as a whole, but to his own country and my own country, the United Kingdom too. These are very considerable crimes. And he's still at it, you know. I don't know if he charges the tariff that he offered to Tucker Carlson, in which he offered to give an interview to Tucker Carlson in exchange for $1 million as a fee. I don't know if he's getting fees anywhere else, but he's still at it, warmongering, seeking to wreck any possibility of a negotiated political agreement, a negotiated peace, an end to the bloodshed on both sides, and indeed including many, many foreign nationals foolhardy enough to go there as mercenaries and so on. There's a whole lot of blood, you know. There's a river Dnieper of blood in this conflict, and much of it is on Boris Johnson's hands, because he, acting as an errand boy for Joe Biden, he went to Kiev and wrecked any possibility of a negotiated peace. That's a pretty serious charge.
I think Mr. Johnson has a column in a British newspaper at the moment where he continues to voice his opinions. Staying with UK politics, though, the leaders of both major UK parties, the Conservatives and Labour, are reported to be considering banning MPs from participating, engaging with groups like the Palestinian Solidarity Campaign. This is a report that they've just had on this, which sort of talks about maybe rolling back the engagement. Why are they trying to do that? What are they trying to achieve? And do you think that they'll be successful?
Well, let me tell you, and let me be the first to tell you, and let you and your program be the first to hear it. There is no earthly power that will stop me from engaging with any legal British political or campaigning organization. So if they imagine that they are going to pass a law which will proscribe the activities of an elected member of parliament like me, well, they better prepare the dungeon now, because I simply will not be bound by any such law. I am very conscious of the political privilege that I have, parliamentary privilege that I have. I am a free man, elected by a free people in a free and democratic election. And no government will tell me how I should conduct my activities as an elected member of parliament. I don't know if this law is just for the headlines, for, I don't know, perhaps part of the election campaign. But if they're serious about it, and they want, as it happens, I have no engagement with the Palestine Solidarity campaign, and none with Just Stop Oil. I don't even support their demand to Just Stop Oil. But if they pass a law saying I can't engage with them, the first thing I'll do is go outside this building and engage with them.
Okay, well, thank you for that. You talked about things being banned there. I think that brings us quite nicely to the situation that we at RT found ourselves in. You've previously hosted a show on RT called Sputnik, Orbiting the World. What do you think of the censorship of Russian media in general in the West? And, of course, that ban that was very quickly enforced by Ofcom in the UK without even a report having been written back in March 2022?
And it was all done in the name of freedom, all done in the name of freedom of speech, free expression and so on. These people are hypocrites. Things like democracy, human rights, rule of law, rules-based international order, and all of that baloney is just lipstick on a pig. They wipe the lipstick off whenever they no longer feel the need to look prettier. And the truth is, there is nothing. As Sunak's speech outside number 10 on Friday about my election makes clear, it's not beyond them even to cancel elections, to invalidate the right of people to stand for elections. It's all just window dressing. And the banning of media, it's not just RT. They've banned Press TV, the Iranian national broadcaster. Even the Chinese TV, CCTV, is no longer available in Britain. They didn't make a political banning order on it, but they just managed to lose their application for the renewal of their license. So there's China, Russia, Iran, there may be others, Telesur in South America, that you just can't get now in Britain. And the reason is pretty simple if you think about it. Too many people were watching these television channels. Too many people were watching RT, not just in Britain, but even more so in Germany. That's why RT was closed down, because too many of the public were watching it. How's that for freedom?
Too many people, free thinkers. You're obviously speaking to us here on RT today, and we're delighted to have had the chance to have spoken with so many different issues with you about. Do you fear, though, that there could be any repercussions for you appearing on RT again?
I've just been thinking about the door behind me being burst open. I give interviews to everyone, from the state BBC mouthpiece to the Chinese to African stations. I give interviews to everybody. I'm a free man. I'm an elected free man. I have the right to speak, and I'll go on speaking to whomsoever wants to hear me, because, you know, nothing is solved by covering things up. Nothing is solved by denying people access to a different point of view. RT used to have a slogan, I don't know if you still do, but it was a good slogan, question more. And that's what we're encouraging people to do. So I don't know if there will be any implications from this interview. I don't care. because it's my duty to speak out to whomsoever will listen to me about what I think needs to be done to try and get some semblance of stability, normality, and peace in the world. And I'm very happy to do it with you today.
Well, we certainly are still questioning more here on RT International. I just want to ask you, you've touched on a little bit of the free speech issues, perhaps, in the West. You know, the West constantly lectures other countries about free speech, about free media. What is your overall opinion right now of the state of media freedom in the West?
Well, a good friend of mine is lying in the dungeon of Belmarsh top security prison. His name is Julian Assange.
We know him well.
He is convicted of no crime, and yet he's being held with mass murderers and terrorists in the worst prison for the worst people in England. And for what? For telling the truth as a publisher. For publishing stories, not a single one of which ever had to be retracted because it was wrong. There is no editor in the entire country who could even dream of being able to say that. But my friend Julian Assange can say it. And he is facing extradition in a monstrous perversion of the extradition treaty that we have with the United States and disappearing for the rest of his whole life for telling the truth about British and American and other war crimes in the war against Iraq 21 years now ago. He will disappear. You'll never see him again. You'll never hear a word from him again. His wife and children will never kiss his face again except through a glass, darkly. That's Britain's attitude to freedom of speech, to freedom of the press. They're forever talking about journalists that get into trouble in other countries, whilst actually imprisoning the world's most famous political prisoner, the world's most famous journalist, Julian Assange, here.
Mr. Galloway, just one final brief question. Is this the new office that they've put you in the House of Parliament?
It's terribly bijou, as an estate agent would put it, but it has a beautiful view. I love this building. I love the British Parliament. I love British democracy. I love my country. I want the best for it. And if only we had a government that felt the same, then we'd be in a much better place.
I'm sure you'll make it very cosy. George Galloway, Member of Parliament for Rochdale in the UK, thank you very much for your time here on RT International.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.